Well, whilst we're finding the presentation, I suppose I can begin by saying thank you for this opportunity to present to this meeting. I hope those of you that have heard a lot about family and child poverty are going to be patient with me. I hope I'm going to tell you something new, something interesting. In the OECD over the past, well, really it's been the past 10 years that the work on families and children has gone beyond simply reporting child poverty figures. You may know about the series called Babies and Bosses, which looked at work-family balance. You may have seen Doing Better for Children, which looked at children's policies and poverty. You may have seen last year we published Doing Better for Families, which looked at a range of policies for families as well as for children. And what you might not know is that last year, just after that publication, we had a meeting of ministers for social policy in OECD countries, and they added to our already rich workload, not just poverty and work-family balance, but the final piece of the jigsaw, which is intergenerational solidarity. So there's no work quite yet, but watch this space. What I'm going to show you today is going to be largely a picture of poverty and policy before the economic crisis. There's a number of papers out and about which will tell you what's happened during the crisis, but there isn't an awful lot of data to show what has truly happened. There's only some predictions. We know what's happened in policy, but I'd like us all to think a bit hard about whether the goals of policies that we see in different European countries are actually doing their job. So it's hard to predict where we're going to go. Okay. So as I said, in OECD, we look at family policy from four different areas, really. We're concerned about fertility. Fertility is an important aspect of sustainability. I think only France and Ireland's quite close to replacement rates in fertility. Intergenerational solidarity is going to be affected by this. Pension burdens are huge, and by the time the generation that's being born today is right in the middle of their work period, the pension costs may have doubled. So we have to think quite hard about sustainability and dependency in OECD countries. We're also concerned about unused labour supply. I'm not going to talk about it a great deal, but you'll know that income inequality is highly associated to poverty in families, particularly market income inequality. That's before governments have a go at taxing and transferring their way to a better life for families. And mostly this is driven by earnings inequality within the family. So second earners is good for lowering inequality and good for lowering poverty. And that leads quite neatly into the idea of gender equality and creating a system that's conducive for women's work. We've just finished a report on gender equality in OECD countries that was highly promoted by the United States. And I think it was, President Clinton. Her husband was President Clinton, soon to be president maybe. Hillary Clinton said that women and girls was the biggest underused resource in modern economies. Economic perspective, perhaps, but a good point made. But I'm going to concentrate on reducing family poverty, enhancing child development. Because I tend to talk too long, I'm going to start with my key messages first. So if people cut me off, you know what our important messages are. Families are at higher risk of poverty than the total population across the Europe in general and in the majority of countries. Despite strong economies, without much wavering, I would say, over 20, 30 years prior to the economic crisis, there was no real reduction made in income poverty. Now, if you reflect upon that in terms of the economic crisis, where people are consolidating, governments are consolidating their budgets, it's a bit of a concern. If we couldn't do it when we had the money, how are we going to do it now? The family well-being is evolving in different directions. The way systems are set up are good for some families, but not so good for others. Child poverty is increasing at the same time as average family incomes. So your average family is richer than they were 20 years ago, but there's more people in poverty. Now that's that would suggest underlying inequality increases. And as Renata said, we could do more in terms of research. We could do better in terms of indicators. And I just want to raise one question here that I'd like people to hold in their mind, and I know that the European Commission have been working on this, particularly with their 2020 plans, but do we really think that income poverty measurements, income poverty indicators, are the best comparator for family living standards, family quality of life? Does income matter that much, or do we need to know more? Now, my argument would be that so much of the research is based upon income, and so much of our systems are built to lower income poverty, and I'll show that in a minute, that it remains to be extremely important, but it doesn't mean that we can't do better, particularly if we're going to move from a sticking plaster approach to family problems, deal with it after the problem has appeared, to a preventative approach. So just, if you know these, forgive me, this is where it might be a bit too simple for some. But there's a few pictures coming, and this is the first one, which is 2009 data. I did try and calculate the 2010 data, but I only had provisional data, and there wasn't all the countries there. So this is a year into the crisis. You can see that the dots are the child poverty, and the bars are the total population, and most of them are above. And in the European 27, total population poverty is around about 16%, and child poverty is around about 20%. Poverty is measured as the proportion of people living with income 60% below the median. Now, the median, when you have your distribution, is not the average, it's the middle point of the lot. Okay? And, I mean, that's higher. That's quite a high threshold compared to what we use in the OECD. We use 50%. And it's equivalized. So it takes into account, if you're wondering, issues of economies of scale in the household. So the more children you have, the less money you need to bring up an additional child, and that's taken into account. Just pointing out some cases there. A couple of Nordic countries and Cyprus doing very well. Cyprus, low income inequality is generally the issue. Denmark and Finland have quite focused policies on at-risk families as well as good universal policies, and I'll tell you a bit more about that later. Hungary, Luxembourg, and Romania, particularly high compared to the total population. This is how the systems reduce poverty in the total population and the child population. If that scale was going to go to 100% and anyone touched 100%, it means that that system totally eradicates poverty. No one gets there. Best is about 75%, and that's for the total population. The tax and benefit systems, on average across the European Union 27, reduce poverty by about 60%, and poverty in children populations by less than 50%. I like to show this chart because there's only one country in the European Union that reduces poverty for children better than it does for the total population. That's just one. That's Norway. Most recent data would suggest Norway has the lowest child poverty rate in the European Union. I just want to touch on a point that Renata made about eradication of poverty. I tried to review the countries that have put in child poverty targets across the OECD, and I found a handful, UK, New Zealand, Ireland, and so on. Had any of them hit their targets? No. Had any of them mentioned eradication? Yes. What did they mean by eradication? We would assume it means making sure nobody is in poverty, right? The UK said eradication represents having one of the best poverty rates in Europe. Well, the best poverty rate in Europe is about 9%. It's 1 in 10 children living in poverty. That's possibly too high, I would suggest, for eradication. We're a long way off hitting our targets. And here's gaps. Not a great deal of difference there, but at the low end where gaps are low, generally low for children too, at the high end when gaps are high, children are a bit more acutely at risk than the general population. And the last one, because Europe has more poverty measures in the Laken indicator set, OECD only really looks at rates. I've added persistent poverty too. Don't have that data for all countries because of the series required to do it. Persistent poverty is living in poverty for 2 out of 3 years. And there's a mixed picture, but there's a handful across the top, Slovakia, Malta, Hungary, Poland, and Spain, where persistent poverty is higher, much higher for children. Looking at poverty rates by age, we can do that too, which part of the population is most at risk of poverty. These lines, these charts, have different scales, so watch out, I'm trying to confuse you a little bit. But they're standardized to 100, and they show 3 different years of poverty rates by age. And for instance, you can see in Denmark that under 18 poverty rate is low compared to over 65 poverty rate. Less of a, it's not really large in the European Union. Much bigger shift in OECD countries is that generally the poverty risk in the younger populations has been increasing, whilst the poverty risk in the pension age has been decreasing. For the OECD countries, we can actually split this up by many more age groups, and most shocking is the spike that you see in youth, not just children, but the people who are going to be the next family, people who are going to form the next families, who are going to run the economy. That's where the highest risk is at the moment, and it's jumped. We require policies for youth beyond employment policies. And just to look at the trends, as I said very early on the left-hand side, that's total population. On the right-hand side, that's sole parent households. And you see Northern Europe, Southern Europe, Western, Eastern split up. But I've put in a few more examples. The red line's the OECD. Since the mid-1980s, population has been creeping up. Sole parent poverty has been the same for 30 years. What does that say for how effective our policies are? What should we be doing? And in the countries that were traditionally doing very well, the Northern European countries, they've not been immune to slight increases either. Just look at the scale. The sole parent scale is twice as large. Sole parent poverty, particularly high risk, sole parents to poverty, and I'll come back to that at the end when we look at policies that work for sole parent families. And I ought to touch on the last description of poverty in Europe, the 2020 targets. Now, I've picked the top 5 and the bottom 5 countries, and I've given you the range of percentage on 3 indicators in that you can make up from the 2020 targets. The first is, on the left-hand side, people with all 3 problems: poor, low work intensity, materially deprived. In the middle, not poor, materially deprived, no work problems. And on the right, not poor, not deprived, but with low work intensities. And something I should have said at the very beginning is that we can compare poverty across countries using our indicator and feel very confident that we're looking at the same things. But what constitutes poverty in different countries is very different, and it requires different policy approaches. We could pick up and learn from each other in terms of aspects of policies, but no one policy could be lifted and dropped in its entirety into another country and do its job. And what we're seeing here is some countries that we naturally assume, because of the weight of evidence, to be very good at lowering poverty, coming out bottom of the multiple risk group. And other countries that we would think, like Bulgaria and Latvia, that we would think to have high poverty risks, appearing at different ends of ranges. And what it says to me is that Bulgaria and Latvia may have very high poverty risks, but very few people who actually experience social exclusion across the broad range. Whereas if you're in Denmark and it's not going well for you, it's really not going well for you. And you need to, the policymakers need to think harder about addressing all of these problems in an integrated fashion in Denmark, whereas in Bulgaria, they may be able to prioritize income poverty first. So why do we look at income poverty? What's the issues with it? Why might we go beyond income poverty? Well, it's a policy-friendly indicator. If I'm in government, I can quickly measure, address, and evaluate my anti-poverty policy if I'm talking about cash. Because I can use a survey, find out how much money people have got, transfer it quite quickly from government budget to private budget, and estimate the effects of that all very quickly, and receive my political economy reward if I'm good. Do I really want to be thinking about investing 15 years down the line or 20 years down the line? Is that my problem? In income poverty, there's a big issue with mis- or underreporting, particularly when referring to low incomes, earned incomes, and benefits. I did some work on estimating income poverty reports in the United Kingdom. Around about 70% of people were telling the truth about it matched with what the government say they were paying to what they said they were paying. And not to mention, go to your surveys in your countries and find out how many Roma people are in that survey, how many institutionalized children are in that survey, how many prisoners, etc., etc., etc. If you look at child surveys, which is a very big interest of mine, ask how many SEN kids are in there. We've got some problems with identifying everybody at risk, and the big problem is that most often it's the people at risk who we don't know anything about, at the highest risk. There's arbitrary thresholds with income poverty by age, equivalization by age. You need more money for a 14-year-old, they say, in the equivalization, than you do for a 4-year-old. Is that the case? Don't you have to offset some of the income that was crowded out from earnings when you have a 4-year-old? Do you have to buy bigger clothes for your 14-year-old? Well, it's questionable, and it doesn't account for issues like disability. Cash as a catch-all is basically income poverty. Say everything about family quality of life. And does it really represent what we consider to be social progress? If one day we do eradicate poverty, do we look around ourselves and say, this truly is a better world, we have everything we want? Well, will we just move on to another problem? And if we do, why don't we address this one at the same time? So here we're going to policy, and I'll try and move a bit quicker. It's a bit old, complicated message here, but let's concentrate on the left-hand side of France, United Kingdom, and Sweden. France, United Kingdom, and Sweden spend more on families than any other country in Europe. The dots show what they spent in 2003. The colour of the dots show you what they've changed. That means they've mostly played with cash benefits. If it's grey, the dot, they've mostly changed tax policies. If it's white, they've mostly changed services. Cash meaning parental leave, family allowances, allowances for single parents, advances on maintenance payments, services meaning transport, social child protection services, food subsidies, and tax meaning tax breaks off earned income. In France, the United Kingdom and Sweden, you will know that the poverty rates in those countries are very different, even though they're spending similar amounts of money. So the how much is spent to drive child poverty question comes into play here. If they're all spending the same, but UK has a high poverty rate, France has a middle poverty rate, and Sweden has a low poverty rate, what's gone wrong? Why don't they all have the same poverty rate? Oh, and perhaps we can tell by the way they spend their money. The dark blue is cash. The mid blue is services, and I mentioned those, and the light blue is tax. Look at the UK, spends two-thirds of its money in cash. Sweden spends two-thirds in services. Maybe that's got something to do with it. I'll skip this one. So at the OECD, we wanted to ask them, we know that child poverty is very different. We know countries have very different policies. We wanted to ask some questions. In order to reduce family poverty, do we want to, is it how much? Is it how? Or is it when that money is spent that makes a difference for children and for families? And these associations, which are four scatter plots, look at how. Okay, so the top left is cash and tax breaks. So you add up the money that's spent on cash and tax breaks per child and associate that to the poverty rate. Then there's childcare on the top left, top right. Other benefits in kind, that's the services, bottom left. Bottom right is everything, all together. Add up all of these payments into one package. So you can see, if you look at the bottom right, per child, the spending in OECD countries ranges from less than $25,000 up to $125,000 per head per year. Those countries spending above average, that's the dotted line, all have below average poverty rates. Those spending below average don't all have below average poverty rates. But the majority of them have above average poverty rates. So really, it's a benefit package is the message we're getting there, but it's not so clean. So we wanted to look at the when question. Families evolve. We're not all the same. What we do depends on the state, the position of our family in this life cycle. What supports we need change. When the child is conceived, to when the child is born, to when you care for the child, to when the child goes into childcare, to when they first start school, through compulsory school, to the school-to-work transition and beyond, require a different set of policies. So we split the policies, the spending up by those policies, and the dark blue is the same thing, cash, childcare is mid-blue, in-kind benefits is white, and the education is light blue. Here's some things that we learned. The first thing is that across the OECD and across Europe, 3 in every 5 euros is reserved for education spending, the compulsory education spending. So you're waiting 5 or 6 years before you put in the bulk of your money. Is that a good idea? We haven't assessed it properly. It's for you to think about. We also find something that's going on in the UK, you can see it quite clearly there, that there's a gap in public supports between 1 and 3. There's this dip. Parental leave runs out, you're not getting your childcare support, and what's a family going to do? They don't have the supports. There isn't a life cycle approach in many countries. There isn't an understanding of policy as a continuum. And despite it amounts to a thin line. I don't know where I fell off, but perhaps I'm talking too long anyway, so we'll miss that bit. The thin line is the service spending. So we can use that to split up cash, childcare, and benefits in kind at different points in the child life cycle and associate that then with different outcomes. I've got PISA, life satisfaction, low birth rate, child poverty, and infant mortality. And the very brief, quick message here is that the business end of policies for poverty are in the early years. That's when spending seems to matter most. When you spread it beyond child poverty, child indicators, and you look at family outcomes, labour market participation, childcare enrollment, gender wage gap, maternal employment, broadly the same picture. Broadly. Spending early matters. It's a complex picture. It looks at, it takes this tax and benefits approach by countries across the OECD and maps it as children age. So you see prenatal through to six to capture that bit where parents' attachment to the labour market is at its weakest. You know, the biggest thing that combats poverty is not the benefits in countries, it's earnings. It's what you bring home from the labour market. No matter what governments do at the margins, it's your earnings. And so the highest risk, the most acute risks to poverty come when your attachment is lowest, and that's when you have a very small child. So we looked at the poverty risks of families as their children age. Now, if the line goes below one, then you're in poverty. If it's at six, then you're six times higher than the poverty rate. The dark blue line is OECD, and the range is the range. So you can have two people earning 50% of the average wage, essentially an average wage for the family. And in some countries, having a child will put you into poverty, not just poverty, but persistent poverty. There is a clear dip in that range too. Again, I'm talking about this age two post-birth area where there's lots of risk. If you're a sole parent, it can be pretty severe. Some countries, there isn't anything, and you're going to end up with persistent, absolute poverty. Some countries, though, are keeping families 2.5 times above the poverty rate. And here's looking at childcare. There are four European countries there in the European average. We looked at the effect of childcare as a service in reduction of child poverty. Child poverty moves from about 18% to about 8% in Europe 23. If you just take the cash, it drops to about 10%. If you just take the services, that's childcare, it drops to about 12%. If you add them both together, it drops to about 8%. In Sweden, childcare benefits has a bigger impact on reducing poverty rates than cash benefits. We're starting to piece together a picture here of early years intervention, of service intervention, and high spending, which altogether is building a pretty effective anti-poverty approach. Sweden is particularly special in the OECD countries, though we don't have data for France, which is a bit of a problem, in that there isn't any income bias in access to childcare. That means mum and dad who are poor get as much access as mum and dad who are rich. And that's very good in accessing the labour market and lowering the income distribution, which we know at the very beginning is associated to child poverty. And around we go in a circle. And the last slide I want to talk to you about is childcare support. Remember I showed you how high child poverty rates were in sole parent families. Well, sole parent families are an increasing family form. They're more and more likely to happen. People talk about family breakdown. I think we need to be very cautious around this area. But what we're seeing is that some child sole parent poverty policies are much better at reducing income poverty than others. There's basically two types. One is an advance on maintenance payments. I, the government, pay you, the sole parent, your maintenance, and then I go and chase the person who's missing and get it back from them. Or there's the other, I, the state, facilitate a legal contract with the parent paying directly to the other parent, and in some cases, when that's paid to the second parent, if they're on social assistance, I claw a bit back, which is going to increase poverty. So what we see on these is, on the left, the decrease in sole parent poverty rate, and on the right, decrease in sole parent poverty rate, mapped against, on the left, the coverage rate, that's how many get the benefit, and then the generosity rate, we could call it, that's how high the payment is. And it's coverage which is associating with poverty reduction, not how much is spent. It's getting the money to those that need it, rather than saying, well, we want it to be 30% of your disposable income or 5% of your disposable income. It's coverage that counts. And the good example in that lot is probably Denmark. Denmark has an advance on maintenance payments. Denmark has a very high coverage rate, not a particularly high payment rate, so it's an affordable policy. Problem is, it's a flat rate, so it doesn't take into account family differences. And there are questions about how effective it is in work incentives and therefore benefit traps. But nonetheless, it's something that countries with high sole parent poverty rates should be knocking on Denmark's door. And here's some relevant links. Thank you.